voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Good morning and welcome to Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Lebensold, your host for this series on the natural world, education, and culture. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, October 23rd, 2008, the 31st day of autumn. We have lost 3 minutes of daylight since yesterday, 1 hour and 14 minutes since last we met 4 weeks ago. Sun rose at 7:16 this morning. It will set at 6:02 this evening. We will have 10 hours and 46 minutes of daylight today. Daylight time ends a week from Sunday on November 2nd, 2 months and 3 days to the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year and the first day of winter on which we will have 9 hours and 13 minutes, which is an hour and 33 minutes less daylight than we have today. And that will be on December 21st, as is commonly the case. The moon rose 1:37 this morning. It will set at 3:27 this afternoon. We are 2 days after last quarter. Next full moon will occur on November 13th. The next high tides in New Rochelle, 8:06 p.m. In Yonkers, 5:46 p.m., Dobbs Ferry, 6:14 p.m., Tarrytown, 6:30, Haverstraw, 6:56, and in Peekskill at 7:09 p.m. Now, our regular feature, the sad part of our program, the names of American service members who have lost their lives in Iraq. May they live on in all of our hearts. 9 American service members died in October as of a week ago today. Most recent report of American deaths in Iraq alone, and this is just Americans and just in Iraq, is 4,186. At least 30,757 have been wounded in action. All of the following 9 men were alive at our last broadcast. Private First Class Hath K. Pickard, age 21, of Palestine, Texas. He died of indirect fire in Baqaba, Iraq, on October 16th. Specialist Justin A. Saint, age 22, of the 8th Airborne, Albertville, Alabama, October 15th. This is called a non-combat related incident. And if anybody ever knows, I keep asking, no one has ever called me to say what a non-combat related incident is. I mean, is it a bar fight? Is it an automobile accident? Is it tainted food? Is it old age? Why do these people die of non-combat injuries in the Army when they're supposedly young and robust? Private First Class Christopher A. McCraw, age 23, of Columbia, Mississippi, small arms fire. Specialist Jeffrey G. Johnson, age 28, Lubbock, Texas, October 12th, also non-combat incident in Baghdad. Sergeant Ruben M. Fernandez, the 3rd, age 22, Abilene, Texas, of a roadside bomb. He died on October 11th. Sergeant Michael K. Clark, 24, Sacramento, California, killed by small arms fire while on dismounted patrol in Mosul, Iraq, on October 7th. Sergeant William P. Rudd, age 27, he was a Ranger, Madisonville, Kentucky. Rangers do it all. They are paratroopers. They are that's the pool from which special forces comes. All special forces must be Rangers. They are the most highly trained soldiers. So that's Sergeant William P. Rudd, age 27, of Madisonville, Kentucky. He died of small arms fire while on combat patrol in Mosul on October 5th. Colonel Michael R. Stallman, age 45, he was a Marine colonel. He was from Chevy Chase, Maryland. He died of injuries sustained also in a non-hostile incident in Anbar province. He was actually injured on July 31st. He died on October 5th. And finally, Private First Class Tavares D. Setzler, age 23, of Jacksonville, Florida, died when a roadside bomb hit his vehicle. I presume it hit his vehicle in Mazar al-Kabir, Iraq, on October 2nd. May these American servicemen live forever in our hearts, and may this feature come to an end in the very near future, because there are no more deaths to report. Okay, it's time for the Culture Corner, my reviews of plays, movies, opera, ballet, museums, and what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions, and you have the right to differ from them, because everyone has the right to be wrong. Okay, this is a film by Oliver Stone called W. This film is not an entertainment, but for me it was an education. The disclaimer that some of it is fictionalized made me wonder which parts, but I trust that Oliver Stone did his homework and that his portrayal of President Bush and his co-players in the American drama of the last 7 years, 9.5 months, and his family life are more or less accurate. If so, my opinions of the key figures has changed. Dick Cheney is no longer the evil, greedy, profiteering, un-American monster I had perceived. He is instead, according to Stone, a relatively sincere neocon who truly believes that imperialism is a noble pursuit in the protection of the American culture. It brings to mind the bumper sticker, "What is our oil? How did our oil get under their sand?" Who believes that Cheney also believes that torturing terrorists who would attack our country is justified, and that overthrowing governments in an attempt to protect our future is also justified. Ditto Paul Wolfowitz, the name which most defines neocon. Karl Rove is pretty much what I thought, a sycophantic, loyal Republican who leaves policy to others but works to ensure Republican victories at any cost. That's a dangerous guy. Very smart, very good politically, and without any conscience, because all he cares about is that his guys win. Even George himself comes across as more sympathetic than I had thought. He seems a true believer and not a wussy, push-around sort of guy. He is, according to Stone, an assertive, not especially smart leader who truly believes that God's message favors him and that his way is right. His relationship with his father was as I expected. Doting Jr., he doesn't like being called that, can never please his father because, in spite of being born privileged, he never did well at anything except remembering the names of his frat brothers during pledge week. Daddy bailed him out of jail, and Dad bailed him out of an unplanned girlfriend pregnancy, and, as is well documented, bailed him out of some AWOLs from his reserve obligations. George Sr. was, and I presume still is, disappointed by his son, especially considering the achievements of brother Jeb, who, though not much portrayed in this film, is clearly the brighter and more accomplished. I think he actually made Phi Beta Kappa, so Jeb actually was the sharper stone in that pile of rocks. Unfortunately for him, the Bush name is now not likely to win anything else. And then Laura Bush. Ah, the lovely Laura. Well-read, thoughtful, and very hot. I had no idea, but if Ollie Stone got this one right, W married way above his station. One thing which went unaddressed by this movie, which absolutely should have been, is the Bush administration's abysmal environmental record and its continuing replacement of solid science with political expediency. For these evils, Bush can never be forgiven, perhaps by his father in heaven, probably not by his father on earth, and certainly not by me. So if you want to see this take on soon-to-be ex-President Bush, see the movie. It moves along well enough, gives the impression more or less accurate, I suppose, of the major players who have shaped your country for the past 7 years, 9.5 months. If you don't need the message, though, don't bother. As I said, it is not an entertainment. That was W by Oliver Stone. Okay, let's just identify ourselves. You're listening to WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening in Eureka, California, St. Paul or Coon Rapids, Minnesota, York, England or Pennsylvania or Albuquerque, New Mexico, you have logged on to www.wvox and you are listening live. Okay, first I'd like to introduce my co-host today, Fred Locker, a former member of the Princeton University staff, joining us from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Welcome, Fred. Are you there?
I am, Bob. Are you there?
Good morning. I'm here, Fred. I'm sitting right here in New Rochelle.
I learned something new this morning.
What was that?
I didn't know that there were high tides in Yonkers.
Yes. apparently, the Hudson River as well as Long Island Sound both have tides. That for some reason, they differ fairly widely. I don't understand that myself, but anybody who would like to call in and educate me, please do. We are, by the way, at 914-636-0110. And anybody who has any comment once we get going is welcome to call in and please be constructive and intelligent about it. No ranting. I think you know who I mean. Okay. Now, our guest, Fred's and my guest today is Bruce Nestor. He's president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. He was former president of the national organization. Joining us from St. Paul, Minnesota, welcome Bruce Nestor.
Good morning.
Good morning, Bruce. Nice to have you on the program.
It's good to be here.
Okay, Fred, would you like to start it off? Do you have some questions for Bruce?
Yeah. Hi, Bruce. How are you?
Good. How are you today?
I am just great, thank you. I wanted to ask you Since you're in the National Lawyers Guild, I wanted to know what the relationship was, if there is any, and what the different functions are of the National Lawyers Guild, say, as opposed to or in conjunction with the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU.
The National Lawyers Guild was founded in 1937, basically to support the New Deal. At the time, the American Bar Association didn't admit African Americans or Jewish members, and was also extremely dominated by corporate attorneys. And so since then, we've been a progressive bar association. Our principle is that we stand for human rights being held more sacred than property interests. And so the American Bar Association has certainly evolved since 1937. It's more of a mainstream bar now that I think probably reflects a diversity of opinion that exists. Many members of the National Lawyers Guild also belong to the ABA, but we are a separate bar association of lawyers, law students, and legal workers that really works to bring about economic and social changes in this country. Again, just the idea that human rights and that the right of people to food, housing, liberty, to speech are more important than protecting property interests.
I see. And then how would you characterize, as I said, your areas of interest versus that of the ACLU? There seems to be some overlap in my mind.
There is some overlap, and we will work together on some issues. I think the ACLU is more specifically dedicated to enforcing constitutional protections across the board, for instance, the right of free speech. And they're more focused on what I would call civil liberties as opposed to human rights. So, for instance, where the National Lawyers Guild will talk about the human rights to housing, health care, and food, those aren't rights that are recognized as enshrined in our Constitution. And so the ACLU would be more focused on the rights to free speech or the rights to a fair trial, the right to have an attorney if you're charged with a crime. Those, the rights that come out of the Bill of Rights.
But you certainly support those as well.
You go further. Absolutely.
Right. But you go further, is that right?
And we will go, I think we have a broader agenda. The ACLU also defends those rights, you know, for the right of the Ku Klux Klan to march in Skokie. And I'm, you know, not taking a position on that one way or another, but that's not our objective. Our objective is to serve progressive organizations, to provide them legal representation, legal advice, who are trying to bring about change in this country, not just the, without speaking, you know, yes, we're for constitutional rights, but that's not our sole mission.
Sure. Now, Bruce, I first became aware of you when I was watching Democracy Now! On television and listening to it on the radio as well. And, of course, that was in relation to the demonstrations and the various arrests at the Republican National Convention a few months ago. Can you kind of give us an overview of what happened there and maybe later on discuss the resolution of some of those arrests? Because, of course, civilians were arrested, so to speak, and many journalists were also arrested for various and sundry crimes, so-called.
Well, back in 2006, we first learned that the Republican National Convention was going to be held in St. Paul. And both St. Paul and Minneapolis have a vibrant and strong activist community that particularly given the war was a big issue at that time. It still is, but it was probably the leading issue. We started to represent organizations that were seeking permits to march and demonstrate. And that was really a two-year struggle. The city of St. Paul fought long and hard against providing any sort of adequate location or space or time for people to march and effectively have their message communicated to the delegates to the convention. And so that was one part of what we did. The second part is we prepared for what we believed would be a massive police presence in St. Paul. We trained lawyers, we trained legal observers, people who go out into the streets and document police interaction and police misconduct with demonstrations. And then that kind of all led up to the 4 days in early September that really, I think, went beyond anything we expected to happen. About 800 some people were arrested. But even more than the fact that a lot of people were arrested, we, the National Lawyers Guild, but as well as ordinary citizens, were really taken aback by the degree to which the city was militarized. Government buildings were surrounded by fences, concrete barriers, wire. The National Guard was deployed to protect the law enforcement center, the county jail, and riot police in extensive riot gear. They call it turtle outfits almost. You know, helmets, padding, shields were deployed in squadrons and minivans where they could run around the city and jump out in groups of eight, groups of 40, and all armed with projectile tear gas weapons to fire chemical irritants at crowds.
Okay, now, Bruce, this sounds like an awfully expensive operation. Who paid for all this?
The federal government appropriated $50 million.
$50 million
to the city of St. Paul, and another $50 million to Denver, where the Democratic National Convention
was
held. So we
paid for this?
And in some way, that really is a driving force. When you have that type of money to spend, it shapes the attitude that you take towards the type of security arrangements to make.
But $50 million, I mean, that you can almost fight a little war with that. What is this, a three-day convention?
Yeah, that's right. A tremendous amount of that just goes to pay overtime. There are 3,500 police were brought in from as far away, well, some from, I guess, New Mexico, Iowa, Tennessee, as well as throughout Minnesota and Wisconsin.
What was it? How did Denver spend their $50 million? Was it similar to this?
Largely similar. I mean, a certain amount is spent on new equipment that then they get to keep and use.
Huh.
A lot of it will be spent on communications, but overwhelmingly it goes to pay overtime. And at that, you know, it becomes fairly lucrative for some of the police departments and individual police officers involved.
Now, tell us about this RNC welcoming committee. This was something that went that kind of got blown up, wasn't it?
Well, the RNC welcoming committee was a group of people, many of whom have lived in Minneapolis or St. Paul their whole lives, who are self-described anti-authoritarian. They might call themselves anarchists, or others would also. And they announced early on that they wanted to host people coming to the city to demonstrate. And they also discussed plans, quite frankly, honestly, to want to blockade buses and try to disrupt the convention. I don't think anybody on either side, either the RNC Welcoming Committee or the police, really thought that they would be able to shut down the convention as opposed to engage in largely symbolic displays of, you know, maybe blocking a street before they were cleared away by the police, of trying to disrupt some of the bus traffic. Those were kind of the announced plans, but the police took that as an opportunity to launch really a massive intelligence operation where they infiltrated political meetings around the country, placed undercover police officers and undercover informants who attended many, many political meetings in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, started to create a database of political activists and who knew each other, who was meeting with each other. And then that culminated in a series of nighttime and early morning raids in the days before the convention.
Wow. Raids, actually raids.
You they know, raided homes
very,
in South Minneapolis.
Very reminiscent of the Nixon era.
Where these young people lived. And, you know, I mean, again, I have a particular viewpoint about what happened, and people can disagree with me. But there are certain things that happened that I just think were clearly over the top. They went into these homes of these young people, some who used to be active in the American Friends Service Committee.
That's a Quaker group, isn't it?
Pardon?
That's a Quaker group, isn't it?
That's right. And they went into these homes with assault weapons, pointed guns at sleeping people. I mean, they really treated this as if they were going after some high-profile terrorist organization that was posed to commit, you know, the most grave and serious crime.
So, Bruce, who is behind all this? I mean, does Cheney put this out? Does Bush put this out? Is it local? I mean, somebody had to produce this show.
We're still trying to figure out who exactly was driving all of this. I mean, one thing is clear is that the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department, which is led by a Republican sheriff in a largely Democratic urban area, they were the driving force behind the infiltration and the investigation.
Is there any investigation of them now that they abused their power?
There are some investigations going on, and there's a kind of an ongoing battle, I think, between the government and people about whether that investigation is truly independent, whether they have the power and the authority to investigate, meaning can they subpoena, you know, testimony and documents to find out what really happened. That investigation right now is being led by a former assistant United States attorney and a former United States attorney who is a prominent Republican.
Bruce, let me just cut you off there. Fred, I think you have to leave us now, do you?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. This has been really interesting.
Okay, Fred, you'll be able to listen
to the rest of the show later on.
You'll be able to listen to it on environmentallysound.org in our archives page. Bruce, you hang on, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes, okay?
Thank you.
You are listening.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York, and we will be right back.
This is the flagship station of Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com. Now, the latest update from Fox News Radio.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lori London. Growing worldwide recession fears as lawmakers try to sort it out. They're hearing from former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan.
Greenspan calls the crisis a once-in-a-century credit tsunami. He says he raised concerns about the mortgage risk back in 2005, but even he's in a state of shocked disbelief over how bad it turned out.
He also says Fox Radio's Mike Mackowitz in Washington.
Greenspan will say that given the damage, he can't see how a rise in layoffs and unemployment can be avoided. He'll say that the administration's $700 billion relief program is up to the task and is already showing signs of working. But he'll warn it'll take many months to fully stabilize the housing market.
And foreclosures rising over 70% in the year's third quarter.
Realty Track, which compiles this data, says by year's end, it's likely more than a million bank-owned properties will be on the market, a third of all properties for sale in the nation.
Fox Radio's Chris Barnes in Washington. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Energy drives our nation's economy and is an important part of our daily lives. By taking steps to become more energy efficient, we can all save money and help reduce our nation's overall energy demand. I'm Energy Secretary Sam Bodman, encouraging you to use Energy Star products and appliances such as dishwashers, washing machines, and thermostats. They can reduce your energy bills by up to 30%. Replacing your existing light bulbs with Energy Star qualified fluorescent lights in the lamps and fixtures throughout your home will save up to 50% on lighting costs. By installing Energy Star storm windows and double pane windows, you can reduce energy loss in your home by 25 to 50%. You have the power to make a difference. By using Energy Star products, you can reduce your home energy bills and help our nation reduce its energy use.
More information on Energy Star products and savings can be found at www.energysavers.gov or call toll-free 1-877-337-3463. This powerful savings message is provided by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Alliance to Save Energy.
This is Bill O'Shaughnessy. For years and years around here, Mario Bulfamante and his sons, Stephen, Anthony, and Benny, have been the royalty of the landscaping and outdoor maintenance world, and I don't exaggerate a bit. Their marvelous new headquarters near the New Rochelle Humane Society off Fifth Avenue and off Potter is not the easiest place in the world to find, I can tell you, but it's the place individual homeowners go on their own for advice on everything that grows. And it's also the place professional landscapers take their clients to select plantings. The Mario Bulfamonte and Sons Garden Center is a Westchester treasure. Call 914-636-4428 and ask for Anthony, Stephen, Benny, or the great Mario Bulfamonte himself for directions. It's Mario Bulfamonte time again in the land, I tell you.
Publish America, the famous Baltimore, Maryland publishing house, presents Huguenot City, the stunning debut novel of Anthony D. Murphy. Renowned, high-ranking Westchester crime fighter Anthony Murphy has written a gripping tale of deceit, ambition, human weakness, loaded with intrigue and brilliant behind-the-scenes descriptions of real life in the suburbs. As a cop, he's one tough, up-from-the-ranks guy who dreamed Murphy could put together a riveting first novel that ranks right up there with the great ones. Huguenot City is a dazzling new 670-page work by a suburban police commissioner who got it right the first time right out of the gate. Anthony Murphy's Huguenot City is available worldwide from all internet booksellers. In Huguenot City, the only thing better than getting a second chance is not getting caught in the first place. Anthony Murphy's Huguenot City by Publish America of Baltimore. Huguenot City, available now at all Westchester and New York area bookstores and all internet booksellers.
Here's the updated weather forecast for Westchester County and vicinity on this Thursday. It's the 23rd day of October. Look for a sunny day and high temperatures into the mid-50s, north winds at 5 to 15. We do have a freeze warning in effect from midnight tonight to 9 a.m. Friday. Clear, widespread frost after midnight, nighttime lows into the upper 20s. Friday's weather calls for a frost early, otherwise sunny. Highs for the day in the lower 60s, clear weather at night. Low 40s. Saturday, overcast and rain likely. It'll be breezy, highs near 60. A chance of thunderstorms on Saturday night. Rain likely. Lows in the lower 50s. Early showers, then partly sunny Sunday near 60. I'm Eddie Rogers, Steve Pelletieri for Whitney Media, WVOX, WVIP.
1460 WVOX.
Okay, we are back. We're talking with Bruce Nestor, but before we get back to Bruce, I would just like to tell you about my friends at The Learning Shop in Harrison, New York. There are all kinds of businesses. There are other tutoring companies, but The Learning Shop is set apart by their personnel and their company culture. There's something about education that invites structure without rigidity, discipline without anxiety, and teaching without stuffiness. The management and staff at The Learning Shop are friendly, educated, and flexible. They're not just intelligent, but they're smart, and the distinction is an important one. Most teachers are intelligent, but that is kind of an internal trait. It doesn't necessarily make you a good teacher. When intelligence comes out into the room, it has the ability to touch others. That's when it becomes smart and good teaching. John and Paul head up the operation, and their even-tempered personalities inspire the atmosphere of relaxed learning. It is a pleasure to visit their facility, where there's always a friendly space in which to share ideas and for students to study in quiet and harmony. If you or someone you know could benefit from private instruction, give The Learning Shop a call at 914-835-1070. That's 914-835-1070. Ask for John or Paul and let them custom tailor a program for you or your school-aged son or daughter. You will be very happy with their services. And incidentally, they provide in-home instruction for probably 10 or 12 or 15 school districts in Westchester and I think even surrounding counties. Not exactly sure, but they are very well established with public education boards as well. Okay, you are listening to WVOX AM 1460, originating in New Rochelle, New York. If you are listening in Tampa Bay, Jacksonville, or Tallahassee, Florida, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, or Pittston, Pennsylvania, Canarsie, or Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn, you have logged on to www.wvox.com, and you are listening live. If you missed any part of this broadcast, you can go to my personal website, which is www.environmentallysound.org. Go to the radio archives page, and this program will be posted shortly. Okay, my guest again is Bruce Nestor, president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. He once was president of the national organization, and he is in St. Paul, Minnesota. Welcome back, Bruce Nestor. Bruce Nestor. Welcome back, Bruce. Okay. I think we've lost Bruce. We're going to try to get him back on again. Sorry for that delay. Let me tell you a little bit about the National Lawyers Guild. As Bruce told you, it was founded in 1937, and it was the nation's first racially integrated bar association. At the time, they were not allowing Jews, people of color, and I believe they also were having a problem with allowing females. And it was in the 1930s that they helped organize the United Auto Workers and the Congress of Industrial Organizations, known as the CIO, and they supported the New Deal. Now, there was also something, and this is something that I want to talk to Bruce about when we get him back. The McCarthy era was bad for them. We are trying to get him back. What's going on, Chris? Okay, he's coming to the phone. When he comes on, we will ask him about the McCarthy era. You'll recall that Senator Joseph McCarthy was a very big a fighter against the what he perceived as un-American activities. Do we have you back, Bruce?
I am back.
Okay, Bruce Nestor is back with us. Sorry, I don't know who's... fault that was, but the problem is solved, so it won't make a difference. I was just trying to fill the audience in a little bit on your organization, and tell us what effect McCarthy, Senator Joseph McCarthy, had on American society and on your organization.
Really, I think it's Senator McCarthy destroyed the careers of a tremendous number of people and drove the political debate really extraordinarily far to the right by making certain issues and topics off limits for anybody that wanted to participate in mainstream society. That certainly was the effect it had on the National Lawyers Guild. When we were founded, we were an organization that included judges, prosecutors, prominent lawyers, government officials, and represented a different perspective on the political debate. We were pro-labor, pro-civil rights, way back in the 1930s, pro-equality. Now, we certainly had our flaws at the time, and we weren't as forward-thinking as today then as we would like to think we are today. But in the 1950s, the whole movement represented by Senator McCarthy was also brought to bear upon the Lawyers Guild. And there was an attempt to label the Lawyers Guild a subversive organization. That was actually defeated in the courts by the Lawyers Guild, and the Attorney General had to withdraw that designation. Admittedly, there were members of the Lawyers Guild who were members of the American Communist Party, but people who had never participated in any sort of subversive activity, but merely represented a different political viewpoint about how a society or how an economy should be organized. And there was really a refusal to deal with that on the merits, but instead to go after people based on their associations and based on these attacks. It really drove many people out of the National Lawyers Guild who wanted to participate in government or the legal system.
And wasn't that true? Sorry to interrupt you. Wasn't that true across the board? All of the organizations that were labeled as subversive, weren't they very often, except let's say the American Communist Party itself was specifically devoted to changing America in a radical way, but many of the so-called organizations which were sympathizers were really just well-thinking American citizens who were frustrated with the way it was, who did not like McCarthy at all, and subversive at that point was exercising free speech. Isn't that so?
Absolutely. I mean, there were people and organizations that were advocating for public housing that were attacked because they were claimed to, associate with communists. And even if there may have been one or two members of the Communist Party involved in some type of organization, that didn't mean it was dominated or led by them, or that anybody deserved to be driven out of the political debate. There were people advocating for civil rights, for legislation, for voting rights, for anti-lynching laws that were attacked. People, particularly in the labor movement, it was very strong, where loyalty oaths were required. And some of the most progressive labor organizers who had a broader vision of what it meant for labor to represent working people were driven out and blacklisted.
And we certainly know what it did in Hollywood, too. Some of those cases are well publicized.
Oh, sure. Now, bring it up to the present day. That's the way it was back then. Now, we're not, there's no Joseph McCarthy right now. And I think the people who are progressive people are no longer as intimidated, and they'll stand up and speak up. But there still seems to be like when I hear some of these conservative broadcasters and just conservatives in general talk about how those of us who think that the war, let's say the war in Iraq, is wrong, and just as an example, and we should bring the troops home, they say, well, that's un-American. We're not supporting the troops. When you have that yellow ribbon on your bumper, on your car, anywhere, and it says support our troops, does that mean that we're for the war in Iraq? It seems to me that if I wanted to support my troops, I'd want to take them out of harm's way. That's just me.
Well, you know, in Minnesota, we have a long tradition of people serving in the U.S. military. And there was a regiment from Minnesota that served in the Philippines during the Spanish-American War. And when they went to the Philippines, they perceived that U.S. troops were going there to not to liberate Philippines from Spain, but to actually suppress an independence movement of the Filipino people themselves. And as recent immigrants to the United States, as people who believed in democracy and liberty and freedom, those Minnesota volunteers spoke up and talked about what they were seeing. And so to me, it's profoundly American in the best tradition of democracy and freedom in this country to say that it's not American to invade other countries, to control natural resources, to intervene in cultures that we know nothing about, and to cause hundreds of thousands of deaths, and to put our own young men and women at risk, and to spend the national treasure pursuing goals that are based upon lies and misinformation from our elected officials.
Absolutely so. But when people speak out against that, somehow, I mean, whether or not you agree that imperialism is a good move, I mean, again, the bumper sticker, how did our oil get under their sand? Let's just say that imperialism is a good thing. How about the people who say, well, no, I disagree? Are they automatically un-American? Are they somehow subversive? Are they terrorists because they say, no, I disagree with that wisdom?
No, it's really an attempt to restrict speech without engaging the issue. And, I mean, those were the attacks that were made upon Martin Luther King, trying to tie him to be un-American communists, so threatening, you know, the social order. Usually 30 and 40 years after the fact, the people labeled un-American are seen then to be the progressive voices of reason and of values that, you know, are universally embraced. But I think it's a method of people who control or shape the public discourse, or at least try to shape it, to freeze out voices, but not on the merits, but rather by these attacks as labeling people as un-American.
Okay, now since 9/11, we seem to have tolerated a weakened Bill of Rights with the wiretaps, with tracking groups and individuals. I mean, it has happened in American history. You mentioned Martin Luther King. Certainly, J. Edgar Hoover took a profound interest in him and in the Kennedys, and he was acting very, skating very close to the fringes of the Constitution by doing that. And now it just seems to be, sure, wiretap us. Now that we have the internet, intercept our emails. I mean, do we as a culture now feel that our security is more dependent on lessening our Bill of Rights as I believe that the Bill of Rights is actually the backbone of our society, and if we weaken it, we lose? What do you think about that?
I think people are willing to tolerate what they perceive as a loss of rights for some groups of people in order to believe that that somehow enhances security. And what often isn't realized is that as you agree to take the protections of the Bill of Rights from some groups of people, eventually it's going to come around to more and more people, including yourself someday. And that's really is what we're seeing. There's just recently the FBI announced a whole new standards, a relaxation of what's required to start infiltrating and monitoring political organizations, where basically it no longer requires a credible threat of criminal activity. I'm also very concerned about the nationalization of law enforcement. And that's one of the things we look back to at the RNC with the $50 million from the federal government, is that we start to apply the types of investigation and the way in which the federal government operates on national security investigations start to be carried out by state and local police, and we start to integrate our local police all the way up with more what I would call the internal security forces of the federal government.
Well, in a sense, maybe I'm not reading you exactly right, but in a sense, let's say there's a criminal, let's say someone is murdered and there's a DNA trace at the scene. Wouldn't it be useful to use federal data banks, DNA, to try to identify this fellow?
Absolutely. What I'm talking about now, for instance, is these young anarchists charged here in St. Paul are charged with a state statute where their acts are called enhancing terrorism, which allows their sentence to be much greater. And I think then by using that word terrorism, even if you want to believe that they were planning to do a riot, which I don't believe is true.
But that's not terrorism.
But it's not terrorism.
It's civil disobedience, right?
That's right. And so we start to, but once you use that, you then justify a level of investigative attention and resources that brings in the FBI, the Secret Service, other federal agencies. And I think there's always been a healthy distrust of the federal government taking a lead role in local law enforcement. Whatever happened in St. Paul with the RNC Welcoming Committee, it's a state concern. It's a concern of the city.
Sure.
It doesn't require the federal government to participate, particularly when these people are treated as terrorists by the way they're charged. And so that's, to me, what is scary, is that we start to integrate in security. We make the government very much stronger. And I think there's a healthy distrust of that, frankly, on both the right, the left, and the middle, from the people in this country.
Now,
the problem is, once the government gets that power, it is very hard for the people to take it back.
Agreed. Now, at the RNC demonstration, journalists were arrested and other activists were arrested. Presumably, many of those people were from that RNC Welcoming Committee. The arrested journalists have all been cleared of charges, but the others have not. Is that correct? What's happening with them?
The city, I think, was pretty embarrassed by the number of journalists who were arrested. And what it showed is that the police were carrying out these mass sweeps where they would surround 70 or 80 people and arrest them all on felony riot charges.
Felony riot charges?
Including the journalists, yes. And then the city, embarrassed, would dismiss those charges against the journalists. But journalists have no greater First Amendment freedoms than the people do to demonstrate. There were people from my neighborhood, where I live in Minneapolis, the son of the local hardware store owner, a Republican, who was riding his bike through downtown St. Paul and got swept up in these mass arrests. I represent college students from North Carolina and Florida that came here to peacefully demonstrate. We're trying to get out of downtown because they were concerned about the level of police force and the use of tear gas. They couldn't get out, and they got swept up and arrested. Hundreds of people were arrested who committed absolutely no crime whatsoever, but were swept up in these mass arrests. And so the same principle that applies to dismissing those charges against the journalists because they weren't engaged in a riot should apply to people who merely happened to be present, and where there's no evidence that they were committing any sort of crime
happened to them? What happened to those non-journalists who got arrested?
Many of those charges are still pending. The city is enormously overwhelmed, and so is the court system, in their ability to process those charges.
And are you, is your organization active in their defense?
We are. Just
Good.
Recently,
Excellent.
For instance, a number of the cases were scheduled for trial on Monday of this week. And the city failed to meet its obligation to turn over evidence what evidence they had. And so attorneys brought motions arguing that those cases should be dismissed. The court then did give the city more time to go over its videotapes and its evidence and produce evidence, if any, that it has against people.
Okay, now I presume these people are not being held. They're out on own recognizance, I would hope?
That's correct. People have now been released. On the other hand, many were released on very high bail. The judicial system basically set the maximum bail for many people. And again, I think there was just this overheated rhetoric believing that If you were arrested, you must have done, you know, something that really was going to threaten public order.
Like riding a bicycle.
That's right. Ordinarily, I mean, people charged with serious crimes, hurting people, sexually assaulting people, were released on conditions less severe than political demonstrators where there was very little evidence they'd done anything.
Well, that happens frequently. People, it depends on where you're tried so much. I mean, people can be dismissed or have their charges dropped in one place and get stiff prison sentences in another. I know that.
That's right.
Let me bring this up to a very current time. I'm sure you're active or at least certainly knowledgeable about national politics. Let's talk about the presidential election for a moment. Do you mind?
That'd be fine.
Okay. Does Barack Obama have a shot, or is racist America and Republican dirty tricks enough of a weight to deny him the presidency?
Well, certainly everything seems to show that he has a shot right now. I guess I speak from the experience of my father, who is a pro-gun, small business Republican.
Listen, I'm a pro-gun Democrat, so what?
Yeah.
I like guns.
Very disillusioned with the war in Iraq and the state of the economy. And I think there's a real fracturing of the Republican coalition, a tremendous desire for change. Whether Barack Obama will bring that change, I frankly think is an open question that I would probably say no. I think there'll be a lot of frustrated people 2 to 3 or 4 years from now. But at least at this moment, there's a potential for a realignment of American politics and a real opening of the dialogue about how do we save this planet. How do we reduce inequality and provide a better life for the majority of people, not only in this country, but the whole world?
Okay, now the Republican Party likes to point a finger in at a bogus issue and then use that issue themselves in dirty ways. For instance, election fraud and voter fraud. They are pointing at organizations like Acorn and other, and they're saying that there's voter fraud. People are trying to register who should not. Who are not eligible to vote. That's a felony. It's hardly imaginable that people are going to risk being arrested on a felony charge just to cast a vote. It's just hard to do. And yet, they use these new laws and rules to actually eliminate the names of people they suspect that the demographic is going to be Democratic, like, for instance, people with Hispanic names, people in poor neighborhoods, African-American neighborhoods. They aggressively eliminate those people from the rolls.
But there's nothing new about that. I mean, you go back to the founding of the country, you had to be a white male with property to vote.
But that was the law.
Then a white male, then men. And as we expand the franchise legally, people have to come up with other means to try to restrict the franchise. And that's what I think we're seeing with these efforts to suppress voters, to intimidate voters, and these fabricated charges of voter fraud being made against organizations like Acorn, where some 13,000 people gathered signatures, and a handful of them may have had getting paid made up some minute names, and yet state law requires that they turn in every name, whether they think it's fraudulent or not. They have to turn it into the state. There's just really no credible basis for these allegations.
So if they see Mickey Mouse on a petition or on a registration form, they can't just eliminate it. They have to submit it.
That's right. They have to turn it into the state official, and then that state official gets to say Mickey Mouse isn't going to be allowed to vote. You know, that's not a decision that the people doing the registration get to make.
Okay. Now, educate me, please, Bruce. I think of election fraud and election tricks as being a Republican dirty trick, and the Democrats are lily white and clean on this issue. Educate me. Am I right, or do both sides do this?
Well, I'm not so sure you're right. I mean, you go back to Lyndon Johnson and his senatorial election in South Texas. You look at some of the votes he may have delivered to Kennedy or Richard Daley in Chicago for John F. Kennedy and Nixon election. Voter manipulation is not unheard of, I think, on the Democratic Party. I think currently, though, that as we have cleaner elections in a formal sense, that overwhelmingly, the manipulation we're now seeing and the widespread efforts to intimidate voters are part of the Republican Party's strategy to suppress votes and to try to win elections. But over time, I don't think you can excuse either party.
Okay, Bruce, I'm afraid that we've come to the end of a very stimulating discussion. I thank you very much for taking the time. And by all means, listen again on environmentallysound.org in a few days.
Thank you, and have a great day.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Fred Locker and Bruce Nestor for joining us this morning. The fuel which runs America's engine is not, as one might think, gasoline. It is free speech. Whenever it is threatened, whenever a single American does not speak his or her mind out of fear of how he or she will be judged, our country is diminished a bit. When these bits add up, as they surely have in the recent past, we are less than we have been and less than we should be. The National Lawyers Guild works to correct that and challenge the forces which would run rough over our Constitution. Activists like Bruce Nestor and producers like Fred Locker, who carry the message to the American people, are the true guardians of our nation. Our thought for the week: when one door closes, another one opens. But so often we look so long and so regretfully upon the closed door that we do not see the ones which open for us. Environmentally Sound airs a special edition a week from today. I hope you will join us. Stay tuned to WVOX, your quintessential community radio station, the flagship of Whitney Radio. Next up, Howard Sterman with the Hometown Hour. Howard will listen to anyone, unpredictable in his opinions, but thoughtful in them, which is all we can ask. Thank you very much for listening. Remember to be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. See you next week. You are here. It is now. Health and happiness to you all.
This is the